speak to you this evening. It's always a treat for me to come back here to this congregation, which I grew up in, and which so many of you have contributed a small piece of who I am today. And so it's always a treat for me to come back and visit with you and to speak something to you from God's Word. I want to talk to you this evening, about how stories relate to our worldview. And specifically, I want to use this morning a piece of text in Joshua 24. If you have your Bibles, turn there with me. These verses won't be on the screen this evening, so go to Joshua 24 with me. And again, just to kind of continue to introduce what I want to speak to you about this evening, it's so easy for us in this, we live in a culture that loves stories. We love them. We have, you know, movies and TV show, even now video games that are telling stories to us, books. And so we're just saturated with all kinds of stories in which we can engage our minds and spend time with. And so I want to look with you tonight at a story in Joshua 24, and it's a portion of text that, if you're like me, is so easy to kind of just skim over. If you ever decide, you know, I'm just going to read through Joshua. Well, when you get to Joshua 24, again, if you're like me, it's always been a little bit of a struggle with a portion of text like Joshua 24, because every so often in the Bible, a biblical character will stop and he'll now just kind of summarize the history up to that point in time in which the character is speaking. And, you know, so often those summaries are filled with maybe events that we're not super familiar with from before in Scripture, or maybe the names of people and places that we're not familiar with, or we kind of just skim over it because we're like, okay, well, I just read this in the rest of Joshua, so why is he now just going through all of it? And so it's so easy to kind of miss exactly what this is doing in the Bible, what these characters are doing, and what the function is of these portions of text. And that's what I want to look at you with tonight as it relates to influencing how we view the world. To start this evening, though, we do need to ask this question, just so we're on the same page. Well, what is it exactly that stories do? Because in our culture, it's so easy for us to kind of think that, well, stories just entertain us. They're just there for entertainment. And if that's all we think stories do, then I submit to you that we are opening ourselves up to the insidious effect that stories have upon us as it relates to worldviews and values that every story promotes. Because every story is created within a culture, and so it promotes values and ideas that that culture values. So I think what stories do, if we're going to think about it, stories promote the values and express the worldview of the culture that produces them. And before I speak about that, just to make sure that, you know, we're clear on what I mean by worldview, I'm talking about a particular philosophy of life or conception of the world. Every culture throughout history has a certain way it views itself and the members of its culture, and it has a way that it views the world. And that culture promotes those values as through the stories that that culture produces for its inhabitants. So, for example, if you look at the stories of Native Americans, they had a particular way of viewing nature and the connectedness of all living things. And those values and that worldview is then promoted through the stories that they tell. If you think about our culture, you know, what types of themes and values does the American culture like in its stories? What does it promote? Well, one thing is underdog stories. You know, Americans just like underdog stories, probably because that's our history. I mean, we started as 13 colonies, and we went up against the world power at the time. It's the ultimate underdog story, and we won. And so we like those types of stories because we like the idea, that promotion of going against something greater and overcoming it. Or we like stories in America where somebody has to pick themselves up by their bootstraps and make something of themselves. We also like in our culture stories about individualism. We're very, we promote that value. We value individualism. We have these expressions in our stories and in our songs. Oh, just be true to yourself. But those values are not universal. They're promoted in the stories of our culture because that's what our culture promotes. That's what our culture values. And so in the worldview of the American Western culture, those things are to be held on to. That's not, though, what you see in stories in other cultures. For example, in many Eastern countries, individualism is not what's prized. It's being true to your ancestors. That legacy that they've left, you be true to that. What you do individually contributes to the community that you're in. And so you're true to that group dynamic rather than just this individual dynamic. And so their stories promote that. And so again, my point here is to show that stories are never just entertainment. They are always promoting and expressing values and aspects of a worldview from which the culture in which they're derived. I want to use one example tonight that it so well illustrates this point, I think, and it's a story that was so popular when I was growing up. It was so popular, and so I think it's a good example to use just to kind of illustrate what I'm talking about, that stories are never just sheer entertainment, that they're always producing some type of value and some type of worldview. And so I want to use the movie Titanic, because again, it was such a popular film, such a cultural phenomenon for anybody who's my age, maybe a little younger and older, and it's a good one to use just because probably most people in here have seen this movie. And so if you think about, just think about this story, and what values is the story promoting? What's the worldview that is being expressed here in this story? Well, when the story begins, you have this character, Rose. She's well over 100 years old. And what's the reason why she's been able to live so long? The movie never explicitly says this, but it's presented in the story. It's that she's had a rich, meaningful life. Why? Because she found the ultimate love in this man named Jack. A love with which, if only any of us could be so lucky as to find a love like that, even if it's just a short amount of time. Hope I'm not giving anything away. The ship does sink, by the way. But even if it's just a short amount of time, if you can just find a love like that, then your life will have been worth living. That's what's promoted in this film. And what about what this movie promotes in terms of human sexuality? What values does it promote? Well, if you've seen the movie, you know as well as I do, sexuality, it's just the natural expression of two people that love each other. Marriage has nothing to do with it. And so in this movie, sure, it's presented in this entertaining story format, but there's values being promoted here, and there's a worldview that has produced this story. And when you think about it, what's missing? What's entirely absent from the worldview of this story? Well, it's God. It's that the ultimate fulfillment in life is a relationship with God. That's nowhere expressed in film. It's the love of another human being. That's the ultimate. That's the ultimate fulfillment in life that you can have, even if it's just for a short time. God is absolutely absent. And any idea of some objective moral authority who has anything to say about human sexuality, again, entirely absent from the film, because that is not the worldview that our culture has. And that's not the worldview of the writer of the story. He doesn't share that view. And so naturally, it's not expressed, it's not promoted in the story that he's producing. And so if I was to ask a Christian, hey, is the love of another human being, is that the ultimate fulfillment in life? I'm sure most Christians would say, well, no, it's the relationship with God. But if I ask them, okay, well, is human sexuality, is that just a natural expression of two people that love each other? Most Christians would say, well, no, the Bible has a very different view of human sexuality. It's for those in a covenant relationship of marriage. And then if I ask them, well, what'd you think of the movie Titanic? Oh, it's a beautiful love story. Well, what happened there? Well, it's that those values that by themselves we would pinpoint and say, no, I disagree with them. But when you wrap those up in the package of a story that's aesthetically pleasing, it's so easy for us to get swept along and we don't even realize our views are changing. We're starting to see things a little differently now because our minds are engaged in this story and now we're seeing things as the story presents it in terms of what the story values, not the values that we would normally espouse. And so stories are always going to have some effect on us. Now, with that in mind, we need to realize how important then the stories of the Bible are. Because the stories of the Bible also are not just given to us for entertainment. God just didn't say, I want to give them a nice story to read. There's a worldview being presented here. And there's values that are being promoted. And as we spend time in those stories, we can't help but have our values shift. We start to see things differently. We start to see things as the Bible presents them. And it starts to change our perception of things. And so stories promote the values and express the worldview of the culture that produces them. And so I want to look at Joshua 24 with you and see what worldview is being expressed, what values are being promoted, and then I want to discuss how that relates to us as Christians. So look at Joshua 24 with me, and let's just start with verses 1 through 5. We're going to read this opening here, and then I'll say something I think is being promoted here. Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and summoned the elders, the heads, the judges, and the officers of Israel. And they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all the people, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, long ago your fathers lived beyond the Euphrates, Terah, the father of Abraham and of Nahor, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from beyond the river and led him through all the land of Canaan and made his offspring many. I gave him Isaac, and to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. And I gave Esau the hill country of Seir to possess. But Jacob and his children went down to Egypt. And I sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt with what I did in the midst of it. And afterward, I brought you out. I want to stop there real quick, because I think in this opening here, as Joshua is now telling Israel the story of their history, I think there's something that's being promoted here we need to recognize right off the bat. Joshua is presenting the worldview of Israel that there is a creator God, Yahweh, and this creator God formed the Hebrew nation from one man. Now, if that's false, would you not agree? What a terribly arrogant view for a culture of people to have about themselves. I mean, think about it. Can you imagine living in a culture whose stories that they tell amongst themselves and that they promote their identity with, they talk about themselves as if they, out of all the nations of the earth, were chosen by the one creator God to be his people. What an arrogant view for a group of people to have. Or, what a remarkable aspect of reality, if this is true. And so as Joshua is telling the story to Israel, he is reminding them, this is who you are. This is the reality we live in. We were created by the Creator God from the offspring of one man that God chose. That is the man Abraham. This is their reality, their identity. Well, keep reading with me. Look at verses 6 to 13 with me. Let's keep going in the story. See what else this worldview, what else of the worldview is presented here. Then I brought your fathers out of Egypt, and you came to the sea. And the Egyptians pursued your fathers with chariots and horsemen to the Red Sea. And when they cried to Yahweh, he put darkness between you and the Egyptians and made the sea come upon them and cover them. And your eyes saw what I did in Egypt. And you lived in the wilderness a long time. Then I brought you to the land of the Amorites, who lived on the other side of the Jordan. They fought with you, and I gave them into your hand. And you took possession of their land. And I destroyed them before you. Then Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, arose and fought against Israel. And he sent and invited Balaam, the son of Beor, to curse you. But I would not listen to Balaam. Indeed, he blessed you. So I delivered you out of his hand. And you went over the Jordan and came to Jericho. And the leaders of Jericho fought against you. And also the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I gave them into your hand. And I sent the hornet before you, which drove them out before you, the two kings of the Amorites. It was not by your sword or by your bow. I gave you a land on which you had not labored, and cities that you had not built, and you dwell in them. You eat the fruit of vineyards and olive orchards that you did not plant. Well, I'm going to stop there and just take a second to look at a couple things expressed here. There's a couple more things expressed here as Joshua is telling the story of what has happened to them up to this point. One of them is that the Creator God Yahweh rescued his people from slavery to bring them to a land he prepared for them. In the worldview that Joshua is expressing, he's saying, look, the reason we're right here right now in Canaan is that the Creator God took us from Egypt with the sole purpose of being His people and of living in this chosen land so we could dwell with Him in a personal relationship. That's why we're here, Israel. That is why we're here. We're here by divine decree. This land is ours by divine decree. And so any current inhabitants either need to be pushed out or wiped out. But also, related to this, I think we see here also that Joshua is expressing that the defeat of Israel's enemies is solely because of Yahweh's intervention in their history. There's no room in the worldview of Joshua 24, there's no room for Israelite military superiority. There's no room for luck. If I was Shane Scott, I'd quote Star Wars and say, Obi-Wan said, there's no such thing as luck. But there is, in Joshua 24, in the worldview of the Bible, there's no luck when it comes to Israel's history. It is all designed and orchestrated and intervened by the hand of Yahweh. He intervened and gave them this land. That is why they live there. That is why all of the enemies of Israel had been defeated. Not because of anything Israel had done, but only because of Yahweh's intervention. Well, let's finish in verses 14 to 28. Let's finish this story. I want to name a couple more things here. Now, therefore, because of everything Joshua's just said, now, therefore, fear Yahweh and serve Him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve Yahweh. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve Yahweh, choose this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods your fathers served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh. Then the people answered, far be it from us that we should forsake Yahweh to serve other gods, for it is Yahweh our God who brought us and our fathers up from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and who did those great signs in our sight and preserved us in all the way we went and among all the peoples through whom we passed. And Yahweh drove out before us all the peoples, the Amorites who lived in the land. Therefore, we also will serve Yahweh, for He is our God. But Joshua said to the people, you are not able to serve Yahweh, for He is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. If you forsake Yahweh and serve foreign gods, then He will turn and do you harm and consume you after having done you good. And the people said to Joshua, no, but we will serve Yahweh. Then Joshua said to the people, you are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen Yahweh to serve Him. And they said, we are witnesses. He said, then put away the foreign gods that are among you and incline your heart to Yahweh, the God of Israel. And the people said to Joshua, Yahweh, our God, we will serve, and His voice we will obey. So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and put in place statutes and rules for them at Shechem. And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and he took a large stone and set it up there under the terebinth that was by the sanctuary of Yahweh. And Joshua said to all the people, behold, this stone shall be a witness against us, for it has heard all the words of Yahweh that He spoke to us. Therefore it shall be a witness against you, lest you deal falsely with your God. So Joshua sent the people away, every man to his inheritance. Well, as the story closes, there's three other things I want to mention to you briefly that are expressed in the worldview, the values that are being presented here in Joshua 24. One is that, did you catch this? In Joshua's view, in the worldview he expresses, good and evil are completely dictated by Yahweh. In fact, to Joshua here, if you read this text, there's only two groups of people in Joshua's worldview. There are those that serve Yahweh and those that do not. There is no middle ground. It's just two groups of people. And those people that want to serve Yahweh have to do what He commands, since He's the only one that dictates what is right and what is wrong. Also, I think we see here that Yahweh's people must choose good as defined by Him if they are to continue enjoying the blessings of being in His covenant community. As Joshua relates to the people, that is Yahweh who defines what is good. In His worldview, He's saying, if you want to enjoy those blessings, you have to follow Yahweh. You have to serve him if you want to enjoy those blessings. And related to this, if you choose not to, there is only one outcome in the worldview of Joshua 24 if you choose not to. That outcome is judgment. And Joshua makes this explicit in verse 20 and also in the recounting of all the peoples who stood against Israel before, as he relates how they were defeated. Joshua is reminding them, listen, if you align yourself against Israel, against Yahweh's people, there is one outcome there, and it's defeat. It's judgment. All of these things are being expressed. All of these things are being expressed in Joshua 24 in the worldview of this story. And so Joshua 24, brethren, is not just a boring history lesson. No, not at all. It is a story of Israel's past designed to reinforce the lenses through which to view themselves and through which to view reality. As Joshua tells this story to Israel, he's reminding them, this is who you are. This is your history. And here are the consequences now, or the responsibilities of this history and of your identity. Here's the responsibilities of living in this reality. You know, throughout the rest of Israel's history, they chose a different view of reality. They chose the reality that there's actually multiple gods and that we can do things like the nations and that really isn't going to interfere with our relationship with Yahweh. They chose to view reality that way. And what Joshua is trying to tell them in this story and all the other spokesmen for God later as they recount the story is, that is a false reality. You are living in a make-believe world and there will be consequences for that. God has expressed to you what the reality of the situation is. As Israel would meet when Israel in the Psalms, as Israel retold their story in the Psalms, and as they met for worship, they did the sacrifices, they met for the feasts, when they came to the temple, all of those things were meant to reinforce the worldview that is being expressed here in Joshua 24, so that they could continually, as a community, remind each other of who they were and what their role was in creation. And so this story gives them the lenses through which to view themselves. And brethren, it does the exact same thing for us. Joshua 24 isn't a boring history lesson. It should be used to reinforce the lenses through which we as Christians view ourselves and view reality. And I want to talk about that for the last few minutes that we have here together. What is the relationship of Joshua 24 and the worldview it's expressing? What's that relationship to us as Christians? That's what I want to discuss with you. As Christians, we accept the worldview of Joshua 24 as the correct lens through which to view reality. When you become a Christian, you are accepting as truth what Joshua 24 is expressing about reality and about Israel. You're accepting that as, yeah, that's the truth. That's true. I want to look at several specific aspects of this here so I can kind of pick apart exactly what it is that we're affirming by becoming a Christian. One is we're affirming to the identity of the Creator God. When you become a Christian, you are accepting the Hebrew claim that yes, there is a Creator, but that Creator is Yahweh. It is not Allah, for example. It is Yahweh who revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When you become a Christian, you're accepting that as truth. That is the identity of the Creator God that created everything that you see when you go outside. And also you're accepting, also you're accepting the identity of the Jewish people. When you become a Christian, you are accepting as fact, as truth, that Yahweh, the Creator God, did indeed create the Jewish people from the seed of one man. That is truth. That's the reality of the history of the world. You accept that as truth. That it is that people that God revealed himself. And it is also, and when you become a Christian, you are accepting it is through that people, the Jews, in which we all have the blessing of God extended to us. It is a Jewish king we come to worship every Sunday. Let's not forget that fact. It is through a Jewish man that we even have a relationship with God, that we can accept his blessing. And we also agree that the Jewish scriptures contain the only correct way to view reality as given by God himself. When you become a Christian, you are accepting what the Jews always affirmed,
that these documents that we have, that now we've collected and put them in what we call a Bible, that these ancient documents, these really are divinely given, that the Creator gave these to His spokesman and had them write them down so that future followers of this Creator God could know, how do we achieve a relationship with Him? How do we know Him? Who is He, the God who created me? We accept that these scriptures are the only revelation from that God. All others are then, by definition, false. We accept that when we become a Christian. And we're also agreeing with the definition of good and evil that Joshua presents. Joshua presents good and evil as defined solely by God. We become a Christian and we accept this worldview. We're accepting that same thing. Good and evil, right and wrong, are indeed dictated by the Creator. It isn't our individual preferences. It isn't society. It isn't a society's laws, necessarily. Sometimes they do align with what God has said. Often they don't. And so we're accepting that God is the sole source for our definition of good and evil. And lastly here, we agree with Joshua 24. When we become a Christian and we accept this worldview, we're agreeing with Joshua there is a judgment coming. And that those who choose not to serve Yahweh, their only end is going to be judgment. We accept Joshua's view that there really are only two groups of people. There are those that serve Yahweh, now through Jesus Christ, the person of Jesus Christ. And there are those that don't. And we accept that as our worldview, we become a Christian. Any other view that there's some middle ground or there's some third option is, by definition, anti-biblical. It is against the worldview that Joshua presents, that the rest of the Bible presents. But I think also as Christians, brethren, we need to recognize that we are the culmination of the story of Joshua 24. Joshua 24 is just one scene, I guess you could say, one scene in the story of God creating a people for Himself. And when we become a Christian, we're accepting we're the culmination of that story. Don't forget what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10. Now, these things that happened to ethnic Israel under the Old Covenant, they happened to them as an example. But they were written down for our instruction on whom the end of the ages has come. The church is not God's second attempt at creating a people for Himself. It's not like God failed the first time and I gotta do something different the second time. The church was always what ethnic Israel was pointing towards. Ethnic Israel was designed to point towards the church, and the church then is the culmination of God's plans in creating a people for Himself. We, the church, are the Israel of God, as Paul describes at the end of Galatians. It is through our relationship with our Jewish King, Jesus, that we become the Israel of God through faith in Jesus Christ. We become the spiritual seed of Abraham, again, as Paul talks about in Galatians. And so we become the recipients of His promises to Israel. Israel never ceased. The idea of Israel never stopped. And now it's just replaced by the church. We are Israel. We're the culmination of everything. The church is everything God was always designing and orchestrating earthly events to reach. Again, as Paul says it, you, Corinthian Christians, you're the ones on whom the end of the ages has come. It's not end of the ages in the sense that, oh, we're just at the end. It's that everything was pointing to you. You are the ultimate purpose. And those before you longed to see what the fruition of God's plan was going to be, but you get to live it. You get to live because you are the culmination of God's creation of a people for Himself. And also, brethren, I think we see here that we promote and profess this worldview every time we meet here. Just like with Israel, ethnic Israel under the Old Covenant, when they would meet for their worship at the temple, the sacrifices, the feasts, and their psalms, they promoted and professed that worldview among each other to remind each other as a community, this is our identity, this is who we are. That's exactly what we do in worship. Every Sunday, Wednesday night, whenever we gather together, and through our prayers, through our songs, through our mutual study of Scripture, through our partaking of the Lord's Supper, where we commune not only with ourselves, but with Jesus as we're anticipating that literal meal with Him when we finally meet Him face to face, that wedding feast that He describes, whatever that's going to look like in that new creation. We're anticipating that and we're reminding each other this is who we are. We are children of God, and we are the Israel of God through our faith in the Jewish man, Jesus Christ. And we remind ourselves of that identity here, and we promote that among ourselves while we're here, lest we start to be influenced by how the world sees things, and now we start to see reality the way the world sees it. And that can be very, very dangerous. You know as well as I do that the world, speaking generally, especially this Western American culture, has no room in its worldview for any type of God who's some moral authority over human beings. Maybe a God who's just kind of a loving grandfather type, maybe, but not a God who's going to come in judgment upon those that choose not to view his son as the only door to him. Our American culture has no room for that in its worldview. Well, and lastly, brethren, I'll just submit to you that as Christians, we have to live this worldview if we expect to enjoy our Creator's blessings. In Joshua 24, as Joshua is promoting this worldview to Israel, he's telling them this story to remind them of the reality in which they live. He is not asking them to adopt just some abstract, different abstract way of thinking. Just think this way from now on, but it won't really manifest itself in your life at all. It's just kind of a different way of thinking about things. That's not what Joshua is expressing. Joshua is telling them the reality they live, and then he is imposing on them, you have to live this reality now. You have to live as if you were brought out of Egypt, out of slavery, to live in a relationship with God. You have to live as if you were brought to this land and given everything you have by Yahweh. None of it was your own doing. You have to live that way. And brethren, it's the same with us. Remember these words in 1 John, by this we know that we are in him. Whoever says he abides in him ought to walk in the same way in which he walked. When you become a Christian and you accept now this worldview of Joshua 24 and of the Bible that it then promotes in these stories, you are accepting as reality that, okay, I now have to live this worldview because there is a judgment coming. You are accepting it as just an inherent aspect of the reality. Christ never asked people to just start thinking about things differently. He asked people to make a life change. You have to live differently now, now that you recognize the reality in which you live. The reality in which you live is that there is a creator, God, Yahweh, who did reveal himself to the Hebrew people and who ultimately revealed himself through the Hebrew Jesus Christ. And now, since he has come, the next stage in the story is the end, which is judgment. There's no more stages now. And so when you accept, when you become a Christian, you're accepting that, as that's the reality. And so when we go to work, we have to go to work remembering, okay, I'm living as if there is a creator God who he defines good and evil. When you go to school, you have to go to school thinking I need to live in the reality that there is a judgment coming. And then it could be today, it could be tomorrow, who knows when it's going to be, but it is coming. And when we're in the privacy of our own homes, we have to live our worldview that the reality is God sees everything that we're doing. And if we choose not to serve him, we are forfeiting the promises that he promised to his people Israel. We're forfeiting. And so that is what we have to do, brethren. We have to live that worldview. In short, we have to walk as Christ walked, because he showed us this is the reality of creation. That there is a God. He's revealed himself through me, Jesus Christ. And now choose how you're going to live your life based on that reality. Atheists, the prolific atheists like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, if you know anything about them, they love to make fun of Christians and to act like Christians believe what they do because they just aren't really capable of dealing with the reality of suffering and all that. And so Christians have adopted a way of viewing reality that there's some ultimate glory in the future that they can look to because they just don't have the inner strength to deal with the suffering of this present life. And they present themselves as, I'm strong enough to deal with it, so I don't need to believe in that rubbish. Well, when you become a Christian, you're making a counter to that. You're saying, I reject that way of viewing the world as false. And I'm countering that this is truly the reality I live in. There is going to be a judgment, and God has promised he's going to save his people, those that put their faith in Jesus Christ. and I'm going to make a decision to live in that reality, and you're trusting that on some day, whenever it is, those people who have accused us of living in a make-believe world are going to realize when they come face to face with Jesus when he returns, they are going to discover they were the ones the whole time living in a make-believe world. They had constructed their own reality in their head, and they were living in a false reality, in a false worldview. And so you're trusting that that is going to be the case. I believe that. I believe that is false. That it is a man-made construct to act like there is no God, or that he is not going to come in judgment. And so, brethren, when we come upon texts like Joshua 24, we have to remember what the purpose of those stories is. They are promoting a worldview and promoting values that you are accepting and adopting by becoming a Christian. And we have to let these values, the worldview expressed in these stories, these need to be what we spend our time with. Brethren, because if we spend, I spend 30 minutes a week reading the Bible, 5 or 6 hours watching Netflix, you're going to be influenced. It is inevitable. Our minds are going to be shaped by something. And so if we start to engage our minds in stories that have no room for God in its worldview, no room for a concept of judgment, no room for any type of objective moral authority that has anything to say about things like sexuality, we're going to start to view things differently. It's insidious, and we can't help it. There's no way to block that from happening. But if we spend our time in texts like Joshua 24, all these stories of the Bible, we also won't be able to help starting to view reality differently, because now we're seeing things the way the Bible tells us to see it. Now we start to value what the Bible values. And again, in the Bible's values, there's only two groups of people. Those that have chosen to serve Yahweh, and those that have chosen not to. And it's already written the end for both groups of people. Well, if you're not a Christian, tonight I haven't spoken a lot tonight about what to do to become a Christian. But if you've not put your faith in Jesus Christ, we are submitting to you that the reality of this life, of this creation, is that there is going to be a judgment. And since we don't know when it's going to be, just as the people in the days of Noah, or just as the people in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah, it may be we wake up, we're going to work as just a normal day, and then it's done. That's it. No more chance of repentance, no more hope for changing your life. It's time for the judgment. Jesus urged people to think about that, to think about the reality of that coming judgment. And so we urge you to do the same. If you haven't made that decision to become a Christian, so that you can know I will be given the promises of Yahweh as a member of his Israel, then we ask you to do that and speak to one of the elders this evening while together we stand and sing.